Welcome to the Nerd Journey Podcast. Our goal is to help you, the technology professional, accelerate your career progression, increase your job satisfaction, and be more effective in your existing role.
We want to bring listeners like you the career advice we wish we'd been given earlier in our careers.
I'm John White at VJourneyman on Twitter, sharing co-host duties with Nick Cordy at NetworkNerd _.
We're two former IT operations guys who have moved on to pre-sales roles with technology vendors. We have our opinions, but we also like to highlight the journeys of others and see what we can learn from them.
We'd also like to ask for your feedback to make this a conversation, not a one-way broadcast. Email us at nerdjourneypodcast@gmail.com or DM us at nerdjourney on Twitter. So come join us on our nerd journey.
Let's take a trip. You're listening to episode 265. Our guest this week is Sean Tallram. He's the head of mindfulness at HSBC. Sean's career path started in his studies of biotechnology and doing scientific research. And you'll find that he quickly realized that wasn't going to be for him. But Sean learned about something called HTML that he really enjoyed. You'll learn about Sean's experience as part of what he calls a grad scheme at IBM and the job rotations he did there. We'll talk through some early career interviews Sean had, and he'll reflect back on it with some interview tips and thoughts through the lens of his experience as a people manager. And we'll also get to hear how Sean was able to foster collaboration with other teams during his time focusing on web design. Here we go with part one of our discussion with Sean Tallram. Sean Tallram, welcome to Nerd Journey.
Hey, Nick. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, appreciate your willingness. Tell us a little bit about what you do and where you work today, Sean.
So I'm currently the head of mindfulness at HSBC. Believe it or not, that is a full-time job. We've set up a mindfulness team at HSBC. And what we're doing is trying to embed mindful ways of working across the organization. So that's my role at the moment.
Oh, wow. That is fascinating. And we certainly want to figure out what led you in that direction. But I want to rewind a little bit and go back to the beginning. When I was doing a little research on LinkedIn, it looked like you were studying biotechnology and somehow ended up in web design. Can you talk to us a little bit about how that came to be?
Oh, wow. You're taking me back now. So I studied science at school. And at the time, I don't know if you'll remember, they just started to work with DNA and they started to talk about cloning and the impact of that and what that might consist of. And then they cloned Dolly the sheep. Do you remember Dolly the sheep? The first animal to be cloned. Yeah, so around that time, biotech was really taking off and it was the next big thing. So I decided to go and study that at uni because I thought, yeah, that's going to be a great career for me to go into. I then realized that working in scientific research wasn't as glamorous as I thought it would be. Many hours in a hot, sweaty lab, wearing a shower cap, growing bacteria, counting the dots. You know, it wasn't exactly what I'd expected. And then I realized that if I was going to take it further, I'd basically have to live like a student for the rest of my life, you know, trying to get grants to fund my research and all of these things. So at the time, I wanted a job that was going to pay me some money. I wanted to, you know, go out and get my own place, pay my own bills. So I decided to leave biotech behind. And I just looked for any other role out there. So I applied to a load of grad schemes, you know, any company whose name I recognized, and got turned down for most of them. But fortunately, IBM took me. So I entered the IBM graduate scheme at that point. That's around the year 2000.
I just want to know if you got a white coat as part of your research, and did they let you keep it when you decided to leave?
Yes, I kept my white coat. I had goggles. Yeah, I had the whole thing going on. Never used them. They ended up in the bin pretty soon after.
Oh, bummer.
Yeah. Yeah, I did that course, and for the people who were genuinely interested, they loved it. But for me, it was every day was a struggle. It's a miracle that I even passed because I didn't want to be there. But kind of my vision was just to get the pass so that I could go on and do something else. And now I think back, I realize that at that age, at such a young age, it's really unlikely that you're going to be able to pick the career that you want to do for the rest of your life. So I think for most people, they'll go through lots of changes as they progress.
Yeah, it's interesting to me. You mentioned applying to well-known companies and brands that you had heard of for your next opportunity. And it sounds like you didn't really care what the focus was. You just were looking for a different opportunity, maybe a exposure to a different field that you might find interesting.
Yeah, exactly. And when I did my biotech course, there was one tiny module which had a little bit of web design in it. And I wrote my first few lines of HTML to display an image on a page. And that, I think it was just maybe a couple of days worth of work. And I found that far more interesting than anything else in my 3-year degree that I did. So I thought, oh, there's something in this. And yeah, I just went out mainly to IT companies, but also to pharmaceuticals as well, just to increase my chances of getting something. But really at that point, I knew that web design was the one thing that I'd sort of tried, and I was intrigued and interested to do a little bit more. I just didn't know how.
And were you practicing and building that skill even on the side as you started to discover the HTML coding before applying for these jobs? Or was it just that basic exposure that you put on your resume for qualification's sake?
I started to do a little bit, because that module that I did, I ended up taking it and building on it over time. So the task was to get an image and stick it onto a web page, totally unrelated to my degree. I don't even know why it was in there. I then took that and added an H1. I then added a table. It was all about tables in those days. All the pages were structured with tables. And I just started to build up the page and add more and more. And it just felt very natural. It felt more natural than anything else I was doing in my degree. And I was finding that I was remembering things very easily. So I'd read some HTML. I'd say, okay, that's how I do a bulleted list. Great. And I'd remember it. And I'd be able to then replicate that and think about different ways to do it. So it all just felt very natural and very easy.
Yeah, there's an interesting parallel there. I mean, the scientific research in the laboratory, you're observing what happens and maybe tweaking your processes accordingly, but you're still trying to solve a problem. And so if I then go into HTML, I'm trying to figure out how to display something on a web page differently or better, or this maybe it's something new I've never been exposed to. How do I display that? How do I make it look more attractive to someone who visits the site? So I definitely see the transferability of the problem solving and the changing of your approach based on what is observed in the output.
That is a very good observation, actually. And we'll probably get to this later, but I eventually moved into user experience, and you know, it's all about test and learn. And when I think back, that's what my degree was about. You're running lots of experiments, you're testing lots of different things, and you're learning what works. So for my thesis, I did a study on mouthwash, where I was trying to figure out which was the most effective mouthwash to use. So I was testing the popular mouthwashes in different conditions to see which ones killed the most bacteria, and then changing certain elements, plugging in certain things, unplugging other things. Yeah, now you mention it, there's a lot of parallels between that and the way that my career progressed.
I feel like there would also be a lot of need to document your observations. Here's what happened. And I don't know how formal it needs to be, because I've never been in the research field, but I'm really curious, how did your writing skills develop to perhaps where they needed to be, new levels for differences in your career later, from being a researcher and having to do some forms of writing in there?
Yeah, I found, I didn't realize at the time, but sort of 10, 20 years later, I'm still kind of using the same principles that I learned when I was in the scientific field. So when we have the results of an experiment, you know, you do your hypothesis, your method, your results, your conclusion. Cut to now, where I'm in a senior management position, if I want to make a proposal about anything that I want to do, the documents that I'm creating have a very similar structure. So really good comparison there. And you can see the similarities.
And did you have to do, as part of your research, did you have to present that back formally to someone who was overseeing the program that you worked under? Because what I have heard, I'll give you an example. Another guest of ours, Neil Thompson, who has a business called Teach the Geek. It's very focused on public speaking. One of the things he mentioned was that it was very difficult when he was in the medical research field to present his findings to high-level individuals in the organization without going too deep, maybe, for that audience. Did you experience anything in the realm of challenges or growth potential in public speaking based on that research?
Yeah, and we quite often had to present the results. When I was an undergrad, we had to present to a room full of PhD students, senior lecturers. And at that point, none of us had ever had any training around how to speak in public. We'd never even thought about it. Then all of a sudden, we have to get up in front of this room where everyone looks miserable. They don't really look like they want to be there. You're talking about something they're probably not interested in, but you know, they have to be there to observe you. And it's a very intimidating atmosphere. You feel a huge sense of imposter syndrome, like you shouldn't even be there. You feel like you're wasting their time. You're in a state of stress. And at that point, I had no idea what stress was and how it can have an impact on the way that you think and behave. So most of my presentations at that time were a total car crash. My heart would have been pumping at 100 miles an hour. I would have been kind of talking like this, breathing very quickly. I'd be all sweaty. And yeah, it was a terrible, terrible experience. And at the time, I just thought, wow, I'm really bad at public speaking. I'm never going to be able to get up in front of a room and speak.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I have an eighth grader and she's not happy anytime she has to present something back to the class. And I just keep saying, listen, it's good to get this exposure now because it's an important skill. And when we say public speaking, I think a lot of people just have this mental picture of a conference room or a keynote from a conference with thousands of people and the spotlight on you. But it starts with to a room of your peers or to a room of people who know more about your subject than you do, and you're presenting it back to them and getting graded. So it can certainly be intimidating.
Yeah, and it's interesting to look at kids, actually, because my kids are 7 and 10, and they're at the age where if they're asked to get up and speak about something, they're like, yeah, just let me at it. I'm going to do it. It's interesting to see as they get older, as they gain these experiences, they go through the education system, how that enthusiasm can be affected.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm glad they're excited about it. I feel like they might be in the minority on that one with the rest of the populace, but that's great to hear. I'll be curious to hear how that goes as they get older, for sure.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the IBM experience. You get the job at IBM, and was there sort of a technical interview that you had to pass as part of that? Tell us a little bit about that one.
There wasn't really anything technical, because I think at the time they were assuming that you'd go there and they'd teach you all of the technical skills that you needed. So it was more to do with personality, whether you'd fit into the IBM culture. I think there were sort of teamwork collaboration exercises, you know, when you've got to get in a room with people and build some Lego and things like that. So a few exercises like that, but nothing actually technical or specific to the work that I was going to have to do. And it's because on the grad scheme, they move you around quite regularly and they teach you a variety of different skills from scratch. So coding, I did graphic design, project management, testing, yeah, various different things. So they didn't really require that level of technical skills at the time.
I feel like that's a good thing we should ask in interviews or read carefully on the job description, how much technical expertise is required or nice to have, and figure out, maybe it's a really good question for listeners doing interviews, will you train me on this specific thing. I'm not to the 400 level you want. I'm probably more like a 200. Are there training opportunities, whether it's on the job or additional courses, to help me get to where you need me to be?
Yeah, and it's funny because now I conduct interviews. I interview people to come into HSBC. And I think back to myself when I was going to those early interviews, and I wouldn't hire me because when I was going to those interviews, it was all about how amazing I was, all the things that I can do, what I can bring to the company, some of it very exaggerated. And it just wasn't genuine. It wasn't authentic. And now that I'm interviewing people, I'm looking for them to talk about the things that you mentioned, those kinds of things. So I'm aware of my current skill set, what I can do. This is all the stuff I can do. I'm also aware of how I can move to the next level because nobody's perfect. Nobody knows everything. But for me, it's really impressive if somebody knows what they don't know and they're already thinking about how they can get there. For me, when I'm interviewing, that gives those people an advantage in those situations.
I like that. But I actually feel like it might be counterintuitive for people to take that perspective because we have this idea of, well, that's a perceived weakness and they're not going to hire me if I show this vulnerability and say that I can't do what they're asking me to do. How would you counter that attitude in today's world?
Yeah, is that old question, that the classic interview question, isn't it? What's your biggest weakness? And then it's like, and then everyone says, I'm too much of a perfectionist. That's always the most popular answer. I think for me, if you go into an interview and you're pretending to have knowledge about things that you don't really have knowledge and you are exaggerating certain things, yeah, it might work. It might work in your favor, but many times it will be obvious and the interviewer will be able to see it. So for me, as long as you have kind of the core skills that are required for the role, you're not totally making things up. You know, you've got the core of what you need and you're showing them. What I like is when they come in and they say, right, I'm aware of the HSBC strategy. So for example, HSBC wants to be net zero by the year 2030. So if they've looked at hsbc.com, they've picked out those types of things. Okay, so we can see the long-term strategy. This is where the business wants to be. This is how I feel like I can develop myself to contribute to that. So I'm aware of what's required. You know, right now, this is where I am. This is what I can do. I feel like I can come in here and I can do a job right now and I can do it well. In addition to that, I'm aware of those areas where I'd like to improve and I'd like to push myself so that I can continue to grow with this organization. And, you know, I think that's such a honest approach. And I really do connect well with people who come in and speak like that.
Yeah. Honesty is the best policy. It's always worked for me. You know, I'm not going to blow smoke and tell someone I know something more than I know. And I would advise others to do the same. But I like what you said, researching the company you're interviewing with in addition to just the job description or job listing, because it's probably going to have a little bit of blurb about the company, but researching the company goals and how you can contribute to those if you worked there, not only in your current state, but how can you grow into better contributing to the company goals? I really like that.
Yeah. And you know, today we have LinkedIn, which I didn't have when I was first applying for jobs. And you know, if you're applying for a role, you can get on there. You can connect with people who work in that company. There was a point where I was planning to leave HSBC and I started applying for roles. So I was connecting with people in other companies, other banks, and exchanging messages with them, finding out what they do, even asking for advice, because you know, people love to feel wanted, to feel needed. And I found it was very easy to go and get good advice from people. So doing that prep work, I think, is really beneficial because it gives you that all-around knowledge of the company and what's going on there. So anything that you can do like that, which will make you stand out from the crowd, I would definitely highly recommend. And even what I really like, actually, just looking at the news. So what's been in the news, you know, whether it's good or bad, but having that awareness of what people are talking about at the moment and giving your take on it. I think that's a great thing to be able to do in an interview.
Absolutely, because it shows that you care enough to take the time to do the research about it. And if you can bring that up in a discussion, I think it shows a level of interest as well. I'm interested in what's happening with this company and what's happening in the environment that it sits and operates. A lot of people go and get a job and it's just a job to them. Others, it's about the work I do. Is it important? Is it purposeful? Is it meaningful? Is it exciting? Do I have a good supportive management chain behind me? And do the values of the company, are they in line with my own? And if they're not, am I going to be able to work there in that environment if they're misaligned?
Yeah, exactly. So there's so much you can do, and it's not difficult to get that kind of information. So on one hand, you've got that kind of background knowledge of the business and the organization. And then on the other hand, the bit that I always talk about is that human connection, because at the end of the day, we're just humans, and we will connect with some people more than others. And that's not to say that you should go in and try and be something that you're not. But if you've gone into the interview and you're perhaps not being yourself, maybe you're so stressed and nervous that you're sitting there, you're being very formal, you're not speaking as freely as you normally would, that could have an impact. So for me, when I talk to young people who are starting their careers, I always advise them to practice interview situations, because the more you practice, the more comfortable it becomes, even if it's to yourself in front of the mirror. It's a bit like, you know, if you're an athlete and you do the training before the big game, you do the training so that you perform better in the game. The interview is the big game. So you don't want to just turn up there with no practice, which a lot of people do. So really putting that practice in and, you know, making sure that when you get there in that situation, you're as comfortable as you can possibly be, so that your true, genuine self can come out and you can make a real human connection with the interviewer.
And I think what you said earlier about reaching out to others in a similar industry or environment where you want to work, assuming you know them, right? Or maybe you don't. Maybe you reach out to them on LinkedIn. But asking people questions like that, what's it really like to work there? That is a form of interviewing. I mean, you're asking the questions, but we should be asking questions of our interviewers anyway when it comes to job interviews. So I think there's an element of practice in that respect, as you said, with connections, interviewing them and getting some extra information and context. But absolutely, the preparation for the interview that really determines whether you're going to get the job.
Yeah. And I'm sure we'll get to the mindfulness bit later. But one of the reasons I got involved with mindfulness is because it's really interesting to think about how the brain works in different kind of work situations. And when you're in an interview situation, you're in a state of fight or flight most of the time, which means access to your higher brain function has probably been cut off because you're firing up your stress response. So you're not able to perform to the best of your ability when you're in that state. So being aware of that allows you to, you know, calm yourself down, get yourself ready, and really go in there and be the best version of yourself.
And this is why people's minds go blank when they have to do public speaking or when they're put on the spot with a question in an interview, or maybe even in a team meeting.
Yeah, exactly. And they say crazy things. I don't think I've ever spoken about this, but I'm going to tell you now. I went to an interview maybe more than 15 years ago, and the interviewer was talking a lot about their culture and how they like to go out. They like to go to the pub. They like to have a drink. And he was asking me if I enjoy going out for a few beers. And as we're talking about, I had brain fog. I wasn't thinking clearly. And the words that I said were, yeah, I drink quite heavily. And as I said it, you know, you get that feeling where you just want the ground to swallow you up. I drink quite heavily. I said that in an interview. And I actually very rarely, the truth is, I very rarely drink. I'll have maybe one beer a month. That's the truth. And it always has been. And I said that in an interview because my mind was all over the place. And I wasn't consciously thinking about the words that were coming out of my mouth.
Oh, no. Forgive me. I had to mute myself because I laughed out loud so hard when you said that. That's terrible.
I'd put that to the back of my mind. I haven't spoken about that since it happened about 15 years ago.
Man, I just triggered you with your post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah. If anyone else has been to an interview and said something that they didn't want to, this might make them feel a little bit better.
Oh, that's so funny. When you were interviewing, thinking back on interviewing for that first job at IBM, did the feedback you were getting on what it would be like to work there match up with what it was actually like when you took the job? And furthermore, I would like to get your feedback on taking a role focused on something that seemed really interesting when you weren't doing it full time to now something you have to focus on full time with HTML. I know I gave you two things, but
yeah, I'll see if I can cope with that. So the first one, the role, I would say, did not match up to what I was expecting, because when I was going through the grad scheme, it was almost like being back at uni, because we had a load of people who just graduated. They were, for a number of months, they were just sending us around doing different types of training. And it was great. It was like, we get to travel, we get to stay in hotels. And it was really, really kind of fun and enjoyable. And actually, it was a great way to introduce people to the company. So IBM did a great job in that aspect. But once I actually got through all the training and onto the proper grad scheme, it ended up being different to what I expected, because they put you on, well, at the time, I don't know about now, they were putting us on placements for a month or 2 months at a time and then moving you around. And some of those roles were roles that I wasn't interested in at all. I'd never done them before. So for example, software tester, I'd be sent to a team to do software testing because IBM had a contract with Tesco. So I'd go to the Tesco head office, sit there, do software testing. Not in the slightest bit interested in software testing. I didn't know if I was going to be good at it, but I sat there, I followed the instructions and I did it. If you do that enough times, it becomes soul destroying, because this amazing career that you dreamed of kind of seems like it's been taken out of your control and you're just being moved around onto these different projects. And I'd say it ended up being something that was very similar to what I experienced at uni, where I was just doing it just to get through, but it wasn't something that was really, it wasn't motivating me, it wasn't giving me energy. But the reason I carried on was because I was receiving a paycheck, I was able to support myself, and I was able to live a comfortable lifestyle. So that was kind of the balance there.
And when you say grad scheme, does that mean that they had a program where they wanted to hire people who were fresh out of school with little experience?
Yeah, so we just finished uni, so I was about 20 years old. And each year they'd bring in a cohort of 30, 40 graduates into the UK. And they'd train up those graduates, kind of immerse them in the IBM experience with the hope that they would then go on to be the future senior leaders at IBM. So they invested a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of effort into those graduates. And at the time, it was interesting because there was a very high percentage of those who did the training and then left. So they've done the training, they get a taste of it, and then they leave. Don't know about now, but yeah, that's what we noticed at the time. When we did the interviews, we didn't realize fully that that's what a grad scheme consisted of.
Oh, okay.
So that was a bit of a surprise.
You know, I have to say, before I started working for a technology company about 6 years ago, I didn't realize that companies had these graduate programs, or some places call them academy programs, where you can come in fresh out of school and they'll train you. But that's a pretty prevalent thing that a lot of companies today have. And that might be a good thing for anyone listening who is finishing up school or already finished with school. Maybe that's an avenue for them to get a leg in.
Yeah. And now I mentor and I coach graduates at HSBC. And the advice that I would give is, it's hard because when you're young and you're in school, you're not thinking about your future career. You're just trying to get through the day sometimes. I don't know about outside of the UK, but the way things work here is that while you're still in university, you can go onto an intern scheme. So you can take a year out of uni and you can work at a company for a year. and then go back to uni and finish your degree. So some companies do that, and it's really useful because once you get into that intern program, that then gives you a better chance of getting onto the graduate scheme and then having kind of that long-term career. So just having a look at an early stage at what these different companies are offering and how you get onto those programs is a really beneficial thing to do. Because once you get onto one of those early ones, because they've invested something in you, they'll end up trying to get you to join because of that investment.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating. I like the idea of taking the year internship and not having to do school at exactly the same time, so you can really be full on in this new bubble and then go back to finish school. That's really fascinating. I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah, it's HSBC do it globally. A lot of big financial institutions do it. I'm sure a lot of the tech companies do as well. So yeah, you've normally got the intern program and the grad scheme. And yeah, that's what I'm involved in now, helping those people to adjust to the world of work, which is very different to what they're used to. And that's the sort of support that I didn't have back in the day when I was starting. And I think that's one of the reasons that I didn't enjoy it, because you're kind of dumped into this environment, which is very strange, very unfamiliar. You kind of feel like you don't belong there. So it's very difficult. And a grad scheme can be very competitive. I always say it's a bit like, you guys have The Apprentice over there, don't you? I know it started with Donald Trump, and now we've got it in the UK. It's a bit like The Apprentice, where it's very competitive and everyone's trying to show that they're better than everybody else around them. So it's a very high pressure, high stress environment.
Because of that, was it hard to make connections with other people going through the program, or was it actually way easier than that?
It's really awkward because you want to make connections, like everyone does. Everyone wants to be friends. But at the end of the day, you know that if you want to get the best roles, you've got to show that you're better than your mate. And so, you know, on one hand, you want to help people if they're struggling, you want to kind of push them up. But at the same time, you want to kind of show that actually I could do that better. It messes with your head. It really does, because it's not a normal way of being.
So where did you end up after you went through all these rotations in your time at IBM? What was the final landing spot, and did you get to pick it?
I was trying to pick it because I realized that I wanted to go into kind of the more creative side. So I'd started working with HTML, and I'd started to build not just functional websites, web pages, but web pages that look nice and provided a good user experience. And at the time, this wasn't really being spoken about much, but I kind of knew that's where I wanted to go. And I told my managers that this is what I'm interested in, but there weren't any roles for that. So I ended up just being moved around to different roles, doing a bit of HTML here and there. A few of them kind of, they let me do a bit of graphic design. So it was the old PaintShop Pro, which is around before Photoshop. I think I was using that at the time, and I was doing some design work and then providing that to the dev teams so that they could put it onto the websites. But there was a massive lack of respect for the things that I was doing at the time, because it was all about building functional websites that worked. Nobody cared how they looked. So I was saying, okay, I think this button should be higher up the page. I think we should have a consistent look and feel. If we're creating something for Tesco, why don't we apply the Tesco branding? No one cared about that at the time. The devs just wanted to get it through functional testing so that they could move on to something else. So it kind of felt like I was on my own, and nobody really cared about the same things.
And what I have seen in the past is that the design function, at least of websites, when I was in internal IT operations at a fabrication company, we had someone who would design the new website, and then we had a company who would go and build it to look like the design. Have you seen that separation continue even to today from the design and build, or are they often combined?
I've seen examples even in recent years where the priority is on the build, and you know, you'll make sure that it's functionally correct. And then once the structure and framework is built, then you think about the design, then you think about the content, the words that are going to be going on the page. So even up until a few years ago, I was still seeing examples of this. But as you probably have seen, I've had experiences where it works really well, where you've kind of got the, you've got the content team, you've got the design team, and you've got the dev team all together right up front, working on the requirements together, and then building something that, that works and does the best possible job. But throughout most of my career, that's not really how it's worked. You've had separate teams, often managed by different people with different objectives, not really collaborating as well as they could.
And is one of the ways that you've seen those teams come together and collaborate, is that becoming more of a product team where everybody is part of the same working group team that's focused on this website or thing as a product? And you've got the design element, the dev element, and the content element, as you mentioned. It sounds to me like what I've heard conceptually product teams are structured like, with a product manager, a designer, and then, you know, an engineering manager that's sort of paired up with that team, and the engineers that work for that engineering manager on the team focused on the functionality, as you said.
Yeah, exactly. That's how I've seen it working best. That's how, over the last few years, we've been moving in that direction at HSBC, where we don't have such fixed job roles and job descriptions. We don't have to sit in the same team and work on a particular thing. If there's a priority for the organization, then the call will go out. We've got this thing that we need to create. Who's able to provide some resource to help us do this? And then you bring in the people with the right skills to do that. And that's something that I'm seeing working really well at the moment. I've had some bad experiences before where, as the content team, you'd receive the website, the basic website, and there's like a tiny bit of space for text, but you've got 10, 12 paragraphs that you need to fit in. In order to fit that in, you've got to send it back to the dev team, who've then got to write new code that then has to go back through testing and then back to you. So it just lengthens the whole process. And I've seen that time and time again.
Just add a scroll bar, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Or we need to make it bigger so we don't have to scroll, change the design a little bit. Yeah, I can see how all those elements are like knobs on this board, knobs on a soundboard, so you can make everything sound right, except you're talking about functionality on a website.
Exactly. And as my career progressed, the one thing that I think really worked well for me was learning a bit about all of those different areas, because at the time I was seeing a lot of specialists. So someone who only does dev, someone who only does design. I started to gain experience in all of those areas, even SEO, user experience, analytics, A/B testing. I ended up not being an expert in any particular area, but I knew enough about those areas where I could work with a team, I could bring people together, I could manage a team of experts. And it was when I decided to go in that direction that I started to be put into more kind of management type positions, because it was seen that, okay, Sean's got a basic understanding of all of these different things. He can bring it all together and get everyone moving in the same direction.
There are two things that I want to dig deeper on what you just said. The first one is, did that first conflict of no one cares about the design, they just care about functionality, is that what caused you to gain or seek out exposure to these other areas? Let's start with that one.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Because I felt like no one understood me and I just couldn't work out what's going on. But then I realized that actually I was doing the same thing as everybody else, because I thought that the visual aspect of everything was the most important thing. So I kind of had to get my own head straight, because if it looked pretty and it didn't work, then that's no good either. That's when I started to think, okay, well, I can create better designs if I understand the limitations that the dev team are facing, if I understand what they can and can't do. So that's when I started to learn a bit more about those different areas. And then testing was always a big one, always a massive battle with the test team to try and get things through. And they were often seen as the bad guys, but actually they're there to maintain a certain level of quality. And they've on many occasions, they could save a company from massive reputational damage through the tests that they run. So understanding a bit more about how testers test and what they need in order to work quicker, in order to be more efficient, that helped a lot as well. So yeah, that was a conscious decision that I made.
What I'm wondering is, did you spend your own time in addition to or on top of whatever deadlines you had to hit in your regular job, researching and working closer with these other teams? Or was that a mandated part of the role?
Yeah, so I actually spent my own time with these teams. So in addition to the work that I was doing, I was then going to someone in the test team and saying, I find what you're doing fascinating, you know, kind of feeding their ego. I'd love to know a bit more about the things you do. Maybe I could shadow you for half an hour just to see a little bit. So I was doing that. Sometimes in my lunch break, sometimes, you know, I'd work out what their schedules were and when they were around, and just finding those small moments. Sometimes it can only be 10 minutes just to see one thing that they're doing. And I consciously spent additional time with those people so that I could understand what they were doing. And what happened was, quite quickly, I was able to link that to the work that I was doing. So I speak to the dev team. What I didn't know was they had certain limitations around button sizes and things like that. So there's no point in me creating a design that has a button size that they can't cope with. Layouts as well, because in those days it was quite tricky, because we were, as I was saying, we're laying everything out in HTML tables. So if I'm creating something with lots of kind of randomly placed images and designs, the dev may be able to do it, but it will take him a week rather than an hour, because the design is so complex. So understanding those kinds of things really helped me. And it helped me to build relationships with those teams. And that was the most important thing. Once we had those relationships going, they were then coming to me and they were saying, oh, Sean, we're building this thing. Where do you think I should put this button? And that's when it really started to come together.
And for the people listening who maybe haven't done this with adjacent teams to what they do, it may not necessarily be design of a website or something. It could be a different function. But were most of the people you spoke to about wanting to shadow them or learn about what they do, were they open to it? Or were you met with some, well, why do you need to know that?
Yeah, there was a little bit of that. Most of it was people took it as a compliment. But some people, yeah, head down, just want to get on with their job, don't care what anybody else is doing. And yeah, you got this young guy who's just started his career. He's asking me about colors and stuff. Why do I even need to spend any time with him? And some of those people, you've just got to brush them off and, you know, not waste your energy on them. So rather than trying to convert those people, I just thought, okay, that's an unhelpful person. I'm not going to do anything more there. It was finding those people who were willing to be helpful. And what I realized was, the majority of people, they want a sense of community. They want to feel like they're part of a team. They want nice relationships, nice conversations. So if you're able to do that, and you're able to be polite and respectful, throw a few compliments their way. The one thing I found really good was giving feedback to their line managers when they did something good. So if I noticed that the dev team had created something really clever, I'd email them, copying the line manager, really impressed with this. You guys did such a great job. I'd love to know how you did that. And just giving positive feedback, making time to build those relationships rather than just focusing on my job. That was what made the difference.
I was about to ask how you rolled up the successes and better relationships to management, but you just answered that one. Keeping management in the loop about how that's going, because I would imagine they see a better output overall because of the collaboration, which often seems like something that we can't quantify extremely well.
Yeah. And through my career, I mean, I've had managers who, they became managers because they were technically good at something. So they weren't going to encourage a collaborative team culture. That wasn't part of their skill set. They didn't care about that stuff. But they were very happy for me to do it because it was one less thing for them to think about. So what I had to learn was how to really sell what I was doing in a way that they could understand. And I wish I did more of this in my earlier career. But you know what it's like? It's awkward to sell yourself and to try and show people how well you're doing. But it's the only way that people are going to know. So I carried on doing what I was doing because I realized this was something I thought was important and I was able to produce good results. So if I can just share the good results and say, look, we've got these really good results, created this end product, the client's really happy. One of the biggest reasons for this is because of the close collaboration between our teams. And I just want to thank you and your team for working so closely with me and for giving me all the information that I needed. It really helped me. And, you know, just having those kinds of conversations, it brings people along, even if they're not really in that state of mind.
Yeah. The art of persuasion, selling, presenting the information that you know to help market the good things, pointing out the bright spots. To me, what you just said, all of that is the on-the-job training for the next interview you need to be in. Because what are you doing? You're presenting the results that you were a part of. Now, of course, you're highlighting the work of other teams, but from a high level, the things you do tactically is somewhat similar and transferable, I think.
Yeah, I like that. I like the way you put that. And it's something that I've really started to think more about throughout my career. At the start, I was focusing more on the work that I was doing and doing everything well. But I could complete 100 tasks really well. And to me, I'd have a sense of personal satisfaction. But it would mean nothing to anybody because it hadn't got out there. But if I can create the story around those 100 tasks in a simple, succinct way that outlines the value that those 100 tasks have provided, then suddenly you have the attention of the right people. And I had that recently, just last year. I wanted to show how we're saving HSBC money. So I created a program within our team where we were simplifying our processes and then recording how much time that was saving us. So at the end of the year, rather than giving management a massive report with loads of numbers and all this stuff, all I gave them was a statement which said, we've invested 30 hours this year in simplification activity. That will now save us 400 hours of effort every year from now on. And that was it. One statement. And I got more of a reaction from that than any of those massive reports that I created in the past.
Oh, I love that.
It's one of those things where I wish I knew this stuff when I was younger. As I've become more experienced and I've seen the way the world works, that's where I've been able to figure these things out.
I feel like some of that understanding of needing to clarify and simplify your message comes with working with and for higher level leaders. So I think this is a perfect time to go into your transition into people management. Speaking of human connections, I want to say a special shout out to former guest Leanne Elliott for making the connection with Sean Talram and suggesting that he be a guest on our show. If you haven't heard of the Truth, Lies, and Workplace Culture podcast that Leanne and Al Elliott co-host, definitely go check it out. It's well worth your time to listen. We did talk a lot about interview advice in this episode. If you're looking for more advice on interviews, I would encourage you to go listen back to episodes 205 and 206. That's our Foundations of Interviews series, as well as episode 81 with guest Manny Sidhu about the joy of interviewing. I love the idea of using honesty to make connections with people in interviews, being honest about the skill set we have and how it can be applied right now. And then thinking about how we could develop ourselves to fit within where the company is going. That same line of thinking, the same responses you might give in an interview, as Sean mentioned, whether that interview is inside your company or perhaps outside your company, those are the same kinds of things that I would recommend thinking about, even if you're just trying to get to that next job level where you are. Maybe you're a senior systems administrator listening to this and you want to get to staff, systems administrator three, whatever the job level is, the next one up, what are the skills that need to be improved or the skills that need to be added to what you already have? Or how does your impact level need to increase across the organization or outside the organization to get to that next job level? That is what I would think about when considering professional development opportunities. How do those fit within the mission of my company moving forward and its strategy? How can I help enable that strategy in my own development? But also look at technology trends and how those are evolving in the market so that as you develop yourself, it helps your career at this company and beyond. All those things are good consideration points. And this exercise of being honest about where you are may tell you that you're not good at being clear and making simple statements of results like Sean mentioned at the very end of that episode. How many of us could come up with a single sentence statement that's more impactful than a report? That, while seemingly simple, it's one sentence, right? But it's very impactful. And that is something that takes work, it takes different attempts, and it also takes knowing your audience. So I think that this idea of human connections can help us build connections with leaders, whether it's our manager, our management chain above our manager, different leaders within our organization. Being able to communicate our work has value. It makes an impact for the organization, whether it be increasing revenue or profit, decreasing risk, or saving time and operating expense. It's something that takes practice. Next week, we'll learn a little bit more about how Sean got into mindfulness and his experience going into people management. See you then.
Farewell, listeners. Tune in next time as the journey continues. I'm John White at B Journeyman, for Nick Cordy at Network Nerd _, signing off.
Adios.